right? This is Dolores Cannon again with the Metaphysical Hour. And we're back again. I know I was off last week, but first let me give out the number, the toll-free number that if anybody does want to call in. The toll-free number is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. And that number is good all over the world if anyone wants to call in. Of course, many of you told me that you don't like to call in because you'd rather just listening. Like to listen because I do have some very interesting guests. I do want to tell everyone that there's a dog in the background. Not on my end. Okay. I do want to tell everyone that Don said now all of the archives of my shows from 2005 and 2006 are now going to be freed. Anyone who wants to go on the VBSradio.com website and look at the shows, and you can download them for free. The 2007 shows will still have to be paid for by a membership. But 2005, 2006, you can download free now. So that's very good. All right, I wasn't here last week because I was in the Bahamas. We had the UFO conference in Eureka Springs 2 weeks ago, and then immediately when it was over, I had to go to the Bahamas to speak in an ashram down there. And I do this about every year, and the Swamis are really wonderful, and I work with them a lot. One thing I think is interesting, this is was a yoga a teacher's training retreat. And they said yoga is becoming so popular now all over the world that they're getting bigger and bigger classes and everything is spreading. So I think this is good that this form of meditation and everything is now coming into the mainstream. It's even talked about on CNN, and they're popularizing a lot of this. Okay, but now I'm back anyway for this week. And my guest tonight is Wendell Stevens. Now, Wendell and I go back, 20 years at least. And he was my guest on this show a year ago when I was at the UFO conference in Eureka Springs. And we did it then from the conference center. So he's going to be on the show tonight. Now, Wendell is like the old standby now in the UFO community. He has so much information that I know he can talk just about anything you could possibly think of in the UFO field, and he has all of the facts on it. He knows everything about it. And he also has the largest collection of pictures of UFOs in the world, I believe. Okay, but you're there, aren't you, Wendell?
Yes. Listen.
Okay. Isn't that true? It's about the largest.
Yes, thing. Over 4,000.
4,000. Okay. 4,000. I didn't want to put a number because I wasn't sure.
Well, it grows all the time.
It keeps growing because I thought it was 3,000.
It was 5 years ago.
But it is the largest collection of UFO photographs in the world, isn't it?
In private hands in the world.
Ah, because I don't think anybody else can approach what you've done with this. Anyway.
Some governments can.
And I just want to go a little bit into Wendell's background, the ones who didn't hear the show last year. But you're a retired colonel, aren't you?
That's correct.
In the Army, wasn't it? Or
Air Force.
Air Force. And he has been so active in all of this. He never let it bother him that he had been in the service because, you know, a lot of people who are involved with the armed services and the government, they do try to shut you up when you get into this kind of material. But Wendell just lectures everywhere and keeps telling everyone all the information he has found. Now, when we were on last year, Wendell, we were discussing the atomic bomb, you know, just to refresh your memory. So we'd like to go into some different kind of material this time.
And well, I tell you, I just got back from a reunion at Giant Rock of all the old-timers from way back in the 50s.
Yeah.
And I had been working with Oswaldo Gonzalez, who went clear back to that period. Him and his identical twin brother were being contacted by alien extraterrestrial entities who at some point gave them a rendezvous point for a future contact a few days ahead. And the point they gave them was not easy to find on the map. It was giant rock, but they didn't know that. And they were trying to find the point, Landers, that's not on the map either. And so they were up in the Yucca Valley area driving around looking for the area, just following their nose, turning here and turning there on impulse. And they arrived at a spot that they thought was satisfactory. And it was night. It was after midnight at night. And they tilted the seats back and started going to get some sleep and wait until morning to see what was going to happen.
Yeah.
They were awakened before dawn by car headlights coming in all and parking all around them. And when they got out of the car to see what was going on, they found out that people were gathering for the second giant rock convention. They didn't even know anything about a convention. Never heard of giant rock or anything else. So there was a deputy sheriff there that was hired to keep order in the crowd. And he was telling people how silly they were to come to such a convention, that everybody knew that this was all pie in the sky, poppycock, that there was nothing to it. And then that morning, an alien ship appeared over the crowd, and deputy, forgot his name again now, took a picture with his police camera of the ship in the sky. It was a lenticular form with a big glow around it. Now, Bob Short and his wife Shirley happened to be in that crowd, too. Shirley's had her camera out, and she took a picture of the same thing. Ackerman was his name. The deputy sheriff's name was Ackerman. Ackerman's picture was published in the Los Angeles Times, if you remember that way back then. The apparition apparently was the entities that the brothers came there to meet. And they did meet them before the Congress was over and had their meeting and even went aboard the ship. They went aboard the ship a number of times, by the way. Oswaldo, after a certain time, keeping records of contact notes. And he had filled 16 scholastic notebooks, you know, the spiral-bound notebooks.
Yeah.
Full of notes of his contacts with those beings who said they came from a planet they called Nep 4. They said Nep 7, the seventh planet out from that sun, also had a space-traveling civilization on it. They gave them a lot of history about Earth's early history. And among other things, we were on the platform there in front of the crowd, and he was explaining a lot of what we had put in his book. And then somebody asked a question, and he said, they told me, actually his entities gave him a number of biblical references to look up. And he did, and he found that the information there was always pertinent to what they were trying to convey to him. So now he's standing there, and he made reference to several of these references, and then he suddenly said, they told me that Jesus Christ did not die on the cross, that Judas Iscariot was not the betrayer, that Judas did not appear at the Last Supper because Jesus was already, Judas was already on his way to Damascus. He would catch up with Jesus' mother Mary and his brother Thomas, and they were all going to travel to the Orient together. And Jesus appeared alone at the Last Supper without Judas Iscariot sitting at the supper, which led weight to the Christian argument that Judas was the betrayer and that he didn't appear at the Last Supper because he felt so guilty. All of that, he told me, was false. That Judas was the only one who could read, the only one who could write, could sum figures besides Jesus himself. And so there was no need for him to betray him for 20 pieces of silver or anything else. The documents that were used to charge Jesus with heresy was Judas' diaries that he was carrying when they came into an inn in Jerusalem for supper that night. And the documents were stolen by Judah Iharion, the son of the high priest, was given the 12 pieces of silver to steal the diaries.
Uh-huh.
Those diaries were what were given to Pilate to prepare the charges, heresy charges against Jesus.
Well, but you know, in my work, I have found, well, it came to me that Judas was the scribe, and that he was the one who was following Jesus around and keeping the records
Jesus kept the diaries for the disciples. He was one of the 12 disciples. He kept the diaries.
Yeah, and that fits right in with what I found.
He also carried the money bag and paid the bills.
Yeah, but he did keep the records of everything that happened.
Yes, he did.
You know, we've always wondered, did any of those records ever survive?
Well, those are the records. That's the diaries that were stolen at that night in the inn where they're eating dinner.
Yeah.
And Judas was, it's just a lot of work, all the writing, and Judas was bemoaning the loss. And Jesus said, don't worry, you can write them again. He said, you don't understand. That's a lot of work. I can't remember all that stuff. Jesus said, you'll remember it.
Uh-huh.
And then later on in Kashmir Valley, Jesus asked him to rewrite the diary. So he sat down and found that he could remember, and he could rewrite them. And that was the mysterious document, the Talmud, that Billy Meyer was led to in the Tomb of the Sepulchre that has become so controversial also, which says the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And Paul Davids, the producer, was in the crowd there. He had just taken Ed Martin, you know who Ed Martin is, around back through India, tracing Jesus' footsteps after the crucifixion, where he taught and lived. And there were records in the monasteries where they stayed. There were records of their teachings. They found a monastery that had a painting from life done by one of the priests of Jesus when he was teaching there way back 2,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But they wouldn't bring it out into the light. They wouldn't let him look at it. They also found where Jesus' mother was buried in Kashmir Valley. They found where Jesus was buried in the Kashmir. Jesus' mother was buried in Mura, Pakistan. She died on the way. She never got to the Kashmir Valley.
Well, I've heard she was buried in Glastonbury.
Well, the bones may have been moved after that, but she died of pneumonia in Pakistan on the way to the Kashmir Valley.
Okay, because that's what I've heard, that Mary and many of the disciples, especially John, were buried in Glastonbury, and even the priests there talk about that. So anyway,
I don't have anything on the rest of them, how they buried.
Yeah, you know, there are so many different stories on all of them.
Well, the interesting thing at Giant Rock is this young man had never heard of the Billy Meyer story. He's been isolated. He doesn't follow the UFO crowd. He doesn't read the literature.
Mm-hmm.
He loaned his notebooks, his collection of notebooks, 16 notebooks, with 4 sets of photographs of the ships that he had taken to his best friend, to take to the best friend's new girlfriend to show him what his friend was doing. The new girlfriend turned out, he left them with her to read over. She turned out to be a born-again Christian. When she saw what she thought was heresy and the lies of the devil, she put them in her fireplace and burned them up.
Oh.
All the records, all the diaries, and all the photographs.
Well, I wonder what Billy Meyer was doing now. We may ever hear about him anymore. Everything was destroyed?
I didn't follow you. What's that?
I said I was wondering what Billy Meyer was doing now. We never hear about him anymore.
Well, he's still keeping notes. He's still having contact. He is taking notes from 2 other sources that took a great deal of work. One was communications from Arahat Athersata, and the other one was from an entity that called itself We Are Petali.
Yeah.
And he filled 2 500-600-page books from each of them, as well as the Palladian contest.
So the other material was all destroyed then?
Which material?
The one you said was burned.
Oh, the material that Oswaldo Gonzalez wrote up. Same thing, but Oswaldo Gonzalez wrote it up in the early 60s before Meyer's contact with the Palladians ever began. And
oh,
it's the same story.
He goes way back then.
Yeah.
But this was the conference you just came from where they were talking about all of this?
Yeah, that guy was 78 years old, and he goes way back to those days. He used to go to those early conferences.
Mm. Well, I know you go to conferences everywhere. You're always speaking somewhere. So I don't think you're going to slow down any time.
Well, I learn a lot at them every time, as you know.
Because, you know, there are so many out there that, you know, we all go to these. Okay, but you want to talk about what you and who was it? Ted, the man who was with you at the UFO conference in Eureka Springs. You were talking about some new information you'd found, at the lecture, weren't you?
Yes, and I don't remember what I talked about at Eureka Springs now.
Well, I think it was the same thing.
Oh, I know what it was. It was the Richard Miller contact that I sat in for about 2 years up in Victorville, California.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing you talked about in Laughlin, Nevada conference, too, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, right.
Some case, I think it was.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to let you get started on something here. We can go in many different directions. This is some new material that you've come up with?
The Oswaldo Gonzalez material, yes, that's relatively new. I've only been working with him for about a year and a half on his material, what
yeah.
he can reconstruct. We put it into a little book called UFO Contact from NEP4. It's about a 350-page book.
Uh-huh. But talk about the material that you were lecturing on.
Okay, that was the Solar Cross brothers that were being channeled by George Hunt Williamson way back in the 50s. And Richard Miller had an experience when he was a teener, and he's now in his early 20s and interested in the phenomena, and found out about a meeting taking place in an old couple's home in Detroit where the members had pooled some resources and bought a ticket for George Hunt Williamson to come to Detroit and demonstrate his channeling of the Solar Cross brothers for the group there. And Miller had gone there that night, and seeing that the crowd was all elderly people and not enough chairs, he sat on the floor by the piano leg. And
yeah.
As the conversation proceeded, drinking coffee and sipping coffee and eating cookies, he leaned back further and further until he was laying on his back under the piano when George Hunt Williamson lay himself down on the sofa, took his three long, deep breaths, and then his body jerked and the channel voice came through loud and clear. At that same moment, Richard Miller's body under the piano jerked, and the same loud, clear voice came through Richard Miller's vocal cords in stereo with George Hunt Williamson. And after that, and after attempting a number of times, Richard Miller succeeded in making contact with the Solar Cross brothers himself.
Yeah.
His long-term channeling sessions began, ran on for years, and resulted in a 400-page book called Star Wars.
Okay, because I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah. That's an older one.
Uh-huh. But what are you working on right now?
Well, right now I'm trying to help Oswaldo Gonzalez reconstruct the rest of his story. I had no idea that he had that information that dovetails so closely and so clearly with the Pleiades case. And now I have to get into that and find out how much more there is to it that has connections.
So it's really very similar to the Billy Meyer material then.
Not really similar. His contacts were informative contacts. They weren't advocating any teachings or anything like that, as the Pleiades were. They were only interested in the identical twin brothers and what they were doing in life and visiting them. And sometimes they came to visit them in couples, a man and a woman together, and they would get out of the ship and go to a juice bar and have fruit juice.
Yeah.
Something like that. That happened a number of times.
Uh-huh.
And then the identical twin brother died about 10 years ago, and those contacts stopped.
Oh, they didn't come after that.
They didn't come after that.
I wonder why.
Well, Oswaldo was so distraught and tore up about his identical twin's death, it took him years to recover. He wasn't paying attention to anything and probably couldn't be contacted easily by the alien extraterrestrials, and they probably may have moved on to something else.
Uh-huh. Because he was so close to him, he got very upset about it then.
Oh, he was very upset about his twin brother's death.
Uh-huh. Well, that makes sense that they wouldn't want to come to him when he was like that anyway. On that part, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Let's, pick a subject you can talk about so much. Is there anything else you want to bring up here?
Well, let's see. The thing I found interesting about the Richard Miller sessions in Victorville is one night we were sitting in session there, and the communicator, there were 13 different entities that channeled through Richard Miller, all with different names, different identities, different backgrounds, different histories from different places, and they were working together as a mixed group conveying some information to their Earth contacts, and there were several of them. One night they suggested we acquire a list of light classics that didn't have words to them, like Tales from the Vienna Woods, Rites of Spring, Thus Spake Zarathustra, Scheherazade, 1812 Overture. Those were some of them, and there was about 15, there might have been about 15 to 18 altogether. We never got them all, but one night we had a stack of about a dozen of them there on the table, and they observed that that might be enough. And then before that session was over, they gave us a list of clips in musical terms to take from those recordings in a very specific sequence. And none of us knew anything about music. We didn't know how to even read the clip that they gave us. So one of the sitters said he knew a sound studio in Hollywood that might be interested. He took it down there, and that studio took the clips out and made nice, clean connections of all of those clips in the sequence required and sent it back up to us on a wire recorder, and we were going to listen to it the last Friday night there when it came up after the session. But during the session, one of the communicators said, we have a little surprise for you this evening. Our brother Monka will call for the music when he's ready. So we got another tape recorder ready and the wire recorder, and then the voice of Monka came on. He identified himself and said, you may now start the music. And so we started the wire recorder and turned the other recorder on too. And right after the introductory note, Monka began a narration of describing a tour of our solar system and what we would see if we were aboard one of their craft, seeing with their eyes in our solar system. And it lasted for 47 minutes without a break, and with a perfectly delivered, perfectly synchronized to the musical score, where there was heavy music, there was 1812 overture drums. When there was traveling music, there was light traveling music from Tales from the Vienna Woods, things like that. That perfectly coordinated with the narration theme, and it was perfectly coordinated in time. The last of the narration landed on the last note of the recorded music, and it was just marvelously delivered. There was no halt, no repetitions, no taking a sip of water, no clearing the throat, no mispronunciations, no speech defects whatsoever. And this young man had no speech training. He had a timid voice. He didn't like talking in front of people. He was sitting in a straight back chair with his hands flat on the table in front of him, eyes looking straight forward, with no prompts, no notes, no cards, no nothing to refer to, and never missing a beat, never missing a word, and never losing his storyline in 47 full minutes.
Wow.
I thought that was miraculous.
Hmm. Yeah, that should convince somebody of something there.
Well, it certainly convinced me. I've had speech training, and at Laughlin we had three Toastmasters in the crowd. We invited them to critique it. They all came to the microphone and said they couldn't offer a single critique. The speech was perfectly delivered. It was done by an alien through another person's voice box, and still they accomplished a miraculous delivery.
Mm. Well, you know, I work with this stuff all the time, so that to me it's not surprising, because I've had aliens come through the people that I work with, and they
can do this.
They use the voice box, and they
on and on and on with no break in time, huh?
Oh yeah, and they give us lots of information, but I had never had it done with music, so that's really different.
Yeah, that was unique, because it's hard to stay coordinated to a musical theme. That means everything has to follow in the right sequence and pace.
Yeah, it would have to have really been rehearsed and rehearsed to get everything right.
Even actors can't do it. For 47 minutes without a prompt, without moving, without anything.
Hmm. Well, did you find the information interesting that he was...
The information was astounding. They described a constructed station beyond our planetary system here. It's like a space port, a man-made space port.
Yeah.
Great starships from other systems come to our system, and and leave survey teams and research teams and study teams. And they talk about cargo being transported in these giant spacers, miles long, cargo being transported from solar system to solar system.
Uh-huh.
And if you stop to think about it, that does not seem that far. You know, we do it between us and our neighbors. We do it between this country and Europe. Why wouldn't we be doing it between Earth and other planets and even our solar system and other solar systems? That's a normal way of business.
Yeah, it makes sense to me because, you know, I'm also...
And they describe these giant ships that are as much as 30 miles long.
Mm.
Constructed space cargo vessels, 30 miles long.
Well, where did they say that the spaceport was located?
They're so big they don't put in at any solar system. They stay in space, and the cargo is shuttled to the solar port in smaller craft.
Okay, so it's not in one certain place. It moves around then.
Well, it's a station in orbit beyond Pluto.
Beyond Pluto. Okay, that'd be way out there then.
On the outer fringes of our solar system.
Yeah, that would be. That'd be way out.
And the ships are so big they can't enter the solar system safely.
Uh-huh.
The forces.
Okay. So I'm just wondering where it was located because I have had information, too, about them, you know, getting materials and minerals and things from the various planets.
Fantastic. I've never heard that.
And taking them somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they come to Earth for. They've been coming to Earth for many, many, you know, thousands of years.
Yeah.
A certain kind of mineral.
Some of the shuttlecraft come to Earth.
They
arrive on these great spacers.
Yeah, it's not the big one, but they do come and get a certain kind of mineral here that they need where they live. And it, to us...
And you know, that boggles the mind, but if you're following the Serpo story, those 12 American scientists that were sent to another planet, When our government prepared them, we started with 600 and winnowed it down to 16 candidates for the trip, of which 12 actually went. But during that time, we began preparing their support equipment to take with them. And by the time, it took 3 years to get them ready. And by that time, we had 90,000 pounds of equipment to send with them.
Wow.
They even sent a vessel that picked up the entire 90,000 pounds, 45 tons, and the 12 astronauts at Area 9 of the Atomic Energy Commission out there, which is above Area 51, north of Area 51.
Yeah.
Picked them all up in one load, went out, and that ship, which was over 100 feet long, it was a fat cigar-shaped ship, it was supposed more like 400 feet long, went out into space and entered another larger vehicle through an airlock where there are dozens of other such ships of that size aboard already.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the trip to the alien planet in the greater ship that was so big they couldn't imagine where the outer edges of it was. And they lived on that for, I think the trip was 8 weeks or something like that. It was a pretty long trip.
That sounds like what I've heard called the motherships. They're really huge.
Yeah, some of the motherships, when I first heard about the Pleiadian mothership being a 10-mile diameter sphere, I thought, this is automatically rejectable because it's too big. Nobody's ever going to believe this. But now we're hearing of motherships that are 5-6 times that big.
Wow, and all I heard was that they said they were like cities, you know, floating cities, and they were huge.
Yeah.
But that would be really big.
Remember in Gulliver's Travels, the folklore myth?
Yeah.
He went to a city in the sky.
Uh-huh. So there's, you know, I always say that the legends and the myths usually have some basis in truth.
Something behind them, yes.
If you really track them back.
And if he found a city in the sky, you know, some cities, even in those days, a city in the sky would be several miles across.
Yeah.
You know, like 8-10 miles across. So the ship would have been some on a size something like that if Gulliver's story has any foundation to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you said that the astronauts were gone for 8 weeks. Is that what you said?
The 12 scientists that we sent to the other planet were sent there to stay 10 years, study the planet and its society, and return. They lost track of time, and they were gone 13 years before they came back. Of the 12 that left, 10 men and 2 women, of the 12 that left, one of them died en route to the other planet, never got there. Two others decided not to return at all. They decided to stay on the other planet, and 8 came back.
That's what I was wondering, if they came back, because, you know, these are things we never hear about.
Well, when they brought them back, they brought them into a special environment that was created, constructed especially for them. When they left on the trip, their families were notified that they had died in a military accident. The insurance policies were all paid off. They knew they were going to be gone for 10 years. The wives remarried. The children grew up. All those things. So when they returned, they never reactivated their existence. They kept them in an institution until they all died. The last one died about 3 years ago.
Oh, well, that doesn't seem quite right.
And they continued to debrief them for the whole. They came back in 73, I think, or something like that. And they debriefed them until they all died. They made 8,000 pages of debriefing notes on the debriefing program.
They probably didn't tell them they were going to do that when they came back.
They didn't tell them that in the beginning, but when they brought them back they realized that to return to their family would be too much of a disruption, and the government was debriefing them anyway and didn't want any of the information out. So they kept them in a special environment until the last one died. They, according to the reports, they filled 3,000 audio cassettes with narrative description on the other planet and took something like 6,000 photographs.
Wow. So they were able to exist on the other planet.
Yes. They did require a little bit of conditioning, but after the conditioning, they were able to move about and breathe the other planet's atmosphere just as well as they could ours.
Uh-huh. I wonder if they had to have any kind of food or anything.
They didn't carry any environmental gear. The aliens provided some environmental gear if they needed it to give them a stronger oxygen atmosphere.
Yeah.
I think they said that the oxygen content of that atmosphere was like 2% higher than ours, and actually the breathing was easier.
Uh-huh. So they didn't have to consume anything while they were there.
Well, yes, they did. They took supplies to last them 10 years, C rations and K rations.
Oh.
But they ran out, but they didn't like the alien food. It was all it was tasteless to them. So they relied on their own rations until the rations were gone, and they had to eat the alien food. And they didn't like that at all, but they subsisted on it for another 3 or 4 years after their own supplies ran out.
Well, the aliens were probably doing the best they could, you know, to substitute.
They were a rational, knowledgeable society that had achieved technology and produced craft, marvelous craft that came here and went back, taking our cosmonauts with them. And the planet didn't have 2 or 3 billion population to draw from for all of this expertise. Their population was only, it was less than 1 billion.
Yeah.
On the whole planet.
Oh.
And still they were building these marvelous craft that could travel in space hundreds of feet, even on an order of miles long, that could make the trip between their home solar system and ours and carry 12 of our astronauts as well as their crew of about 40.
Mm. Well, you know, in the work I've been doing, I found out that a lot of times they just shift dimensions.
Yeah.
You know, they raise and lower the vibrations and frequency of the craft, and that way they can go into other dimensions.
That was another thing that our scientists mentioned several times, was when the craft was moving, they weren't required to sit down and be belted in the seats, and they never felt any inertial forces.
Yeah.
And the aliens explained to them that the inertial forces worked on every particle of every atom simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
So the inertial forces were not felt. They weren't experienced.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because that was what I was told, that, you know, the other investigators always said, well, they got to have some kind of fuel or something to propel the ship to go so many miles, light years, to the next planet. But that's what I've been heard, that it doesn't work that way. They just raised the...
You know, they told our scientists that their ship was powered by thought.
Uh-huh.
Concept.
That makes sense, because they told me it was also to do with the cosmos. There's a tremendous amount of energy out there.
And when you get right down to it, everything that you perceive in our physical world is nothing but slowed down thought, crystallized thought.
Okay. That makes sense with the work I'm doing, because they did say that there are a lot of energy out there, and that's what they use. They've learned how to harness that.
Yes.
They have huge crystals on board the spacecraft that store this energy. So it doesn't have to be some kind of a fuel that, you know, like they talk about combustion to engines. It's not that way at all.
No, they don't have to carry fuel. They do have to carry food supplies.
Yeah. But the aliens don't use food.
Some of them don't need food.
Many of them don't. They just absorb energy also.
Directly, yes.
They said they absorb it right through their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way, you know, they've got to that point. Eventually, they said, we will get to that point also.
Well, these entities did require alimentation. They had their own system of alimentation aboard the craft. But our cosmonauts did not like the alien food.
Well, they were probably trying to duplicate what they thought we eat, and they forget about.
They tried to synthesize something. When our food, our astronauts' food ran out, the aliens tried to synthesize something like our food, but it was never very successful.
Yeah, I was thinking they wouldn't understand about the taste part. You know, makes a difference.
Yeah.
But they probably would have been better if they would have stayed there then, if they would have known what was going to happen to them when they came back.
Well, yeah, but we don't tell them all that until we got them back here and doing the debriefing to make the records.
Yeah. Well, I've been told, too, that there's a lot of lost astronauts and that their families were told they just died in accident.
Yeah.
So I believe what you're saying because, you know, we both get this strange information.
Yeah.
But do you know anything else about what they found, or do you have any access?
Well, they found that the planet was a little bit warmer than ours. It had a zone that was hotter than ours. We went to about 125, 130 degrees Fahrenheit in the summertime, in the middle of the day. They did have polar areas that had mild climates, but they didn't have big polar ice caps like we have. Mm-hmm. They didn't have large bodies of water. They manufactured their water.
Okay. Well, they always say this is the water planet.
Yeah.
You know, we're different in that way.
Yeah.
Did they have bodies like us?
Yeah. There were not a lot of other creatures on the planet. There was a creature that was like a big lizard, 10 feet long.
Uh-huh.
They killed one to eat it, and the populace of the citizens of the planet were horrified that they killed a creature and then tried to eat it on top of that. They shunned them for some time after that. They thought they were terribly contaminated.
Yeah. Well, that's what they always say. They're afraid of us, you know. They said with our violence and everything.
To kill a creature to them was something horrible. Something real. It was like murdering a human, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's what they've always said, that how can someone kill someone else?
You know, when Bob Renaud was taken to the planet Corindor by his visitors, they told him that he would be surprised at the freedom of the animals. And when he got there, their animals, native animals, none of them were confined. None of them were kept in zoos or in habitats. They all roamed the streets with the people, foraging for whatever their particular foodstuff was, but there were no predators, no carrion eaters, nothing. No creature ate another creature.
Oh, okay.
And the whole planet was like that.
Hmm.
So there are better planets.
Oh, yeah, that's
what
I found.
With better schemes aboard.
That we're kind of on the bottom rung, really, of the ladder.
We really are. We really are the primitives.
In my work, I haven't found any negativity. You know, that a lot of that is what people say, but I haven't found it at all.
Yeah.
That they are really much more civilized, I guess you would say, than we are.
I haven't found any real bad ones either.
No.
But I haven't been looking for them. I've been looking for the ones that are interacting with their Earth contactees in a friendly way and are accepted. They accept each other. I guess there are other such cases if I wanted to look for them.
Yeah, because I found that a lot of what people think is bad experiences are just because they don't really understand what happened.
Yeah.
And their emotions get in the way. And in my work with hypnosis, I'm able to remove that conscious part, the emotional part, and then we find out what really happened. And it was not that bad of an experience because we understand why it was happening.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference.
You know, one time, when Billy was contacting the Pleiadians, a number of other entities were able to find him with handoff information from the Pleiadians on his brainwave pattern. And they would approach him for contact also. And one time he asked him, Yasi, he says, shouldn't I be worried about being kidnapped and taken to another planet? She said, well, you don't have to worry about that. She says, some people would not be as safe. She said, there is a law of affinity. Like attracts like.
Yeah.
She said, unless you are of a nature that you would capture something and imprison it yourself and take it away and torture it, they're not going to be attracted to you. They will be attracted to those who are of a mind that would do that. And they said, those people, when they're captured and taken to an alien zoo on another planet, have only merited what they deserve, what they've created for themselves all along.
Sounds like karma, really.
That's karma at work.
Yeah, you know, karma, what goes around
comes around. Billy, you don't ever have to worry about that. It's not in your nature to be captured and taken to another planet.
Well, you know, you attract what you fear, too.
Yeah.
And you attract that to you, and you give it focus and power,
yeah.
So you do draw it to you.
Yeah.
It makes a difference, you know.
Oh, I believe in manifestation. We're manifesting here all the time.
Oh, yeah.
That really works.
And they've been here since the beginning of the world.
Yeah.
That's why I said if they wanted to hurt us, they could have done a long time ago.
If they wanted our planet, they could have taken it before we got strong enough to even raise fingers.
But you saw the new documentary, didn't you, Fast Walker?
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember on that. I liked it because they were looking at it from the positive point of view.
Yeah.
And in there, they said there has never been a case that on record of them harming anyone.
Yes.
So I said that was good because that's bringing out what I keep trying to bring out. And I think the documentary was very good.
I thought it was an interesting documentary.
Bob Dean is still around because he was in there, and I haven't heard from him about him in quite a while.
Who?
Bob Dean.
Bob Dean lives up in Phoenix, yeah. He's not as active anymore. He's slowed down considerably.
Uh-huh. Well, I did see him when he was having heart problems, and I saw him on the documentary, and I was wondering if he was still active or not.
His appearance in that documentary is probably the last one he has appeared in so far.
That was filmed quite a while ago.
Yeah.
But, so he's not doing any more conferences or anything?
Well, he would like to, but when it comes time to go, he's not ready to go.
Uh-huh. I knew he was having heart problems, but I think he got over part of that.
A little, yeah.
So I was just curious about it, and I just happened to think of that.
He allows himself to get weaker and weaker, though, and you know you don't have to do that.
No, it's all in your mind anyway.
Yeah.
It's what you want.
Yeah, I keep telling him you don't have to be getting weaker. You're accepting.
It's all in, you know, what you believe and what you draw to you. You know, that's what I keep saying. You don't need to grow old.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I know you're older than I am, but we're still going.
Yeah.
We're not going to stop anytime soon.
I don't intend to. I like it. I enjoy the new information. As many cases as I've examined, in every one there's something new that I didn't know before.
Yeah, that's with me. I'm so curious. I want to know more and more.
Yeah.
That's why I'm still writing, because there's always something different out there.
Yeah.
And the mind is where you grow old. If you let it go, you know, you just have to keep it active. But I thought of something. What about the Chicago O'Hare case?
No, I don't know anything about that.
Uh-huh.
I've watched some of the notes on the internet about it. I am pretty much convinced that it really happened.
Yeah.
They had too many authoritative witnesses that were trying to tell their story that the government was trying to suppress at the same time.
Yeah.
And that tells me a lot. When the government is in there trying to confuse and suppress information and make it all look bad and give people problems, that's the signal to me that it's real, and watch for the truths of it.
Yeah, they try to make the ones who are saying they saw it, they try to make them look ridiculous. And they try to make fools out of them. Then you know that there really is something going on. Because these were people who deal with aircraft all the time.
You turned away from your microphone.
What?
I lost you there for a minute.
Yeah, there's static on the line. There's been static the whole time. No, I was saying these were people who deal with aircraft all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, over a hair. They know what they're seeing.
They were experienced people that see aircraft all day long, every day.
Yeah, and so they knew what they were seeing was definitely out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they can say that they, you know, they try to make you appear like a fool, what the government does.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, you know, I interviewed Timothy Good at the conference,
yeah.
And he said in his new book, he found there were a lot of airplane crashes that were caused by, he said, with the interaction with the alien craft. And I'd never heard that before.
You know, I never hear that either of our airplane crashes. I think they're quickly suppressed. When I was out on Okinawa, a flight of three straight-wing F-84s was coming into the air base at Kiyoshima, and war had just ended, and so they really made a combat approach, which is approach the airfield on the land in the direction of the landing runway
yeah.
at high speed, like 300 miles an hour, pull up into a steep climb, drop the flaps and the wheels in the top of the climb, and when you come out, you have enough drag, you come just straight down and land on the runway.
Yeah.
And so they call that a pitch-up, a combat pitch-up. So these three F-84s came in to Iwo Jima, made their pitch-up, and the lead airplane hit something in the clouds, and it went out of control and crashed in the ocean. Whatever it hit just flew off. So the two wingmen landed, and they were all shaken up by the collision just ahead of them. And when the Air Force wanted permission to drag the ocean for the remains of the craft that went down, the Navy refused immediately, and then they got orders from Washington, don't recover the airplane. Leave the airplane and the pilot's body right where it is. It was never recovered. And that was published as a mid-air collision, but they didn't say what it collided with or anything else. When the airplane was dropped from the inventory, it was just said due to mid-air collision.
But see, you can't blame that on the ETs either.
Not a mid-air collision. It
no,
could be anything.
He didn't. Well, neither one of them saw each other. Probably. Well, the
but nobody wanted
more about it than the other.
Higher levels didn't want anybody looking at the remains of whatever was left of the aircraft if they recovered it.
Oh, I would have thought they would have been curious.
I would think so.
Uh-huh.
They probably have enough information now they don't need more.
Uh-huh.
Or by then even they had it.
Well, that was what Timothy was talking about, that we had shot down several ships.
You know, that's what Richard Boylan says, too, from his information.
Yeah. And I don't know. You know, Timothy said that he'd done a lot of research, and that's the first time I'd ever heard of anything like that.
Well, I know that we have operational discs built by this country. I'm told that we have four squadrons of them deployed. That's, if it's fighter aircraft, it's 15 aircraft to a squadron. The deployed ones are in hardened underground facilities in rock mountains that are excavated for the base.
Yeah.
And even the host country doesn't know they're there.
Well, I know there are underground cities.
Yeah, we have two squadrons in this country in underground facilities, too. And the later later discs can take off under their own power, ascend into orbit, remain for as long as the food supplies and toilet supplies last, and then return under their own power and land again. They don't need boosters or anything else. And the operational ones in this country are servicing a military space station out there that's bigger than the NASA space station, and NASA has no control over it. It's operated entirely by the military.
Well, I know there's a lot of things in the, you know, that have been shot up there that we don't know, you know, besides the space station. There's a whole lot other things up there for other reasons.
So I don't know why we're kept so much in the dark. The public is told nothing about what their money is being spent for.
I know. They don't tell people half of what's really going on.
Yeah.
But I did investigate a case, it's been several years ago, of a UFO that had crashed, and it was like a Roswell. So Roswell is not the only one out there.
No, there. I'm aware of 16 crashes that I have on record here.
Yeah.
And I know that's probably less than half of what had actually happened.
This one, I was trying to remember, it's either Kentucky or Tennessee. And when I told Lou about it, he said he hadn't heard of that one. And who was it? Stringfield, wasn't he the one who was the expert on the crashes? The one who died?
Wait a minute. Leonard Stringfield.
Yeah, wasn't he the one? And he was going to ask him if he'd heard about this one. But that was several years ago. This man came to me because he said he was in the Army, and they were in a helicopter, and they landed there because they thought it was an aircraft that had crashed.
Yeah.
They went to help, you know, with it. And when they got there, they saw it was a UFO.
Yeah.
And he said when they got out and went inside of it, there were the bodies, but they were all dead.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that made it believable to me was that he said there was not blood. It was like clear liquid.
Oh, interesting.
And so me, that made it more believable. But he said just at that time, another helicopter landed that was full of officers. And they told them to get back on their helicopter and get out of there, and they would see him back at the base.
Oh, interesting.
And then when they got to the base, this man said they separated all of them.
Yep.
And they, you know, questioned them and brainwashed them for hours and hours without
until they agreed they didn't see what they saw.
Yeah, they kept saying, "You did not see what you saw. You know, it wasn't real," and on and on and on, and "you will not talk about it," and all this stuff. And then they told them if they ever did speak about it anywhere, that they would hunt them down and kill them and their families.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And then they separated all of these. They shipped them off to different bases so they would never have contact with each other again. And I think it sounds very believable.
That's a very plausible story.
Yeah, because he was scared to tell me, but he did show me his discharge to show that he was in the service and stationed at this place.
Yeah.
But he was worried. He was having nightmares about were they going to come and hurt him or not. The government, not the ETs. So there's a lot more than just the Roswell story.
You know, when I was at the Aztec crash reunion conference up in New Mexico about 3 weeks ago, a man came to me there at the conference. He was staying in the room next to me in the hotel. He handed me a picture of his father. His name was Brophy, and he said that my father was a B-29 pilot flying out of Roswell Air Base, and he was returning to base when he kept flying as making his a low approach for his pass over the base, and he passed over the San Antonio wash that ran under the freeway and towards Roswell, I guess it was, the wash did.
Yeah.
And his father saw what he thought was a crashed airplane in the ravine, in the wash.
Yeah.
And he landed at Roswell. He called the operations, told him there was a crash out there on the other side of the highway, and he got a vehicle and went out there to see if he could help anybody.
Yeah.
When he got on the scene, there was a UFO, and there was four occupants in it. Two of them were still alive. The two of them were dead. And he tried to help the ones that were still alive do what he could for them. When the base recovery team complement arrived, and they ordered him away and run him clear out of the area and out of sight of the place.
Mm.
There was two Mexican boys that had been riding ponies, and they saw his father inspecting the crash. They stayed on the ponies at the distance, and they saw the government people come and begin the recovery. They got backed off behind the hill and sat on their ponies and watched the recovery for a couple hours. And when the team left for the end of the day, they went down to the site and picked up some pieces of the crash residue and took it home.
Ah.
They still had that.
Well,
and they had gotten in touch with, Brophy, the son that was talking to me, had that information from his father, so he went to some pains to find the two Mexican boys, now adults. He did find them, and he found that they did, in fact, take the residue from that wreckage and that they still had it, but they didn't want to give it up.
I don't blame them, but I'm watching the clock. I'm going to have to sign off because he will pull the plug. But
It's been pleasant.
Okay,
thank you, Dolores, to talk to you another time.
Yeah, and thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Oh, you bet. Okay, goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye, Wendell.
Yep, goodbye.
Okay. Good night, everybody.